Now we are working 16 hours, 12 to 16 hours. And then the first thing they tell me is we want a work-life balance for our workers.
In today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy, National Strike by Nabisco Workers.
In the wealthiest city in the country, in the world, students are going to school in a rat-infested building.
Students and teachers in San Francisco are demanding safety from COVID.
And the United States, we've been propping up that apartheid government for a long time with our tax dollars, and that's something that we need to stop.
On Labor Day, trade unionists are fighting for Palestinian workers.
You know, it's like there's no regard for workers' lives. We're essential, but we're expendable.
New York TWU transit workers face both COVID and massive flooding in the transit system. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On Labor Day 2021, U.S. workers are facing both COVID and massive floods. There's also a growing wave of labor strikes from Alabama miners who have been out for more than 5 months to Nabisco workers who went on a national strike in August. On August 10th, over 1,000 unionized bakery plant workers at four Nabisco plants went on strike. They make Oreos, Ritz crackers, and Chips Ahoy in five states across the country. Nabisco is part of a multinational food conglomerate called Mondelez, which has closed multiple facilities and laid off thousands while sending jobs to Mexico and other countries. Striking bakery, confection, tobacco workers, and grain millers, international union workers, talked about how the company is trying to bust their union.
Right now, we are in the biggest fight against one of the biggest corporations in America. Not just America, the world. These guys right here have the courage to be out here fighting for their rights. Fight rights that our predecessors gave them, that we must continue to fight for. Every day I wake up and I see my fellow brothers and sisters in Chicago, Richmond, and Portland out there walking the line. And until those lines go down, I will be here. I will be there supporting you one way or the other. It wasn't easy to go out on strike, as you guys know. No one wins a strike. But you know what? We can't take it anymore. We're seeing record profits in corporations. We're seeing just corporate greed. Since the 1920s, we have not seen this kind of greed. Now we are working 16 hours, 12 to 16 hours. And then the first thing they tell me is we want a work-life balance for our workers. Fix it. They have the ability to fix that. Hire more workers.
We need everybody here. We need your support. We're not a very big shop, but we're out here fighting like hell. This company's greedy. All they care about is the almighty dollar. All we want is a fair contract and for them to not take anything from us. They're making record profits and sales have been sustained this year as well, but they still need to take more from us. We've had enough. They already took our pension. Isn't that enough?
People can be forced to working up to 60, 70 days. I've personally worked 45 days in a row without a day off.
We want to be treated like we're people instead of like slaves.
The company has never given us anything, but corporate greed is taking everything away. And we'll be out here until we can stop corporate greed.
They came with some demands in the last negotiation that were all takeaways. They wanted to take our overtime away. They wanted to put us on a 7-day work schedule, 12-hour days.
They currently want to change our overtime pay so that if you work all that time, you will end up eventually getting paid less for working that amount of time.
Your impact is going to be about a $40,000 a year loss for all the workers across the board.
They've actually closed two factories recently, and they don't disclose where their production's going, but we know it's going to Mexico.
It sucks. I just turned 55 years old, got 37 years.
With the COVID-19, I don't know who's going to hire me right now.
Is everything going to Mexico? All of it.
I grew up with Nabisco products, Oreo, cream and crackers, Chip Ahoy's. I knew they were made here. I knew they were made around the corner from where I live. To see those things go to another country where people are making less pay and the company is still making billions, it's disheartening.
I've been here since 1987, so I guess it'd be 34, 35 years. This company has actually squeezed everything out of it they could.
They don't even want us to step onto the grass of the property, so they're putting a fence up right on the property line. They're basically kicking the employees to the curb.
We want the community to support us. We want America to support us. We don't want you to buy Nabisco products. Not during our strike. When we come back to work, we want you to support Nabisco products, but only Nabisco products made in America. If you read the back of the label, it will say made in America, or made in Mexico, or made in Canada. And we want to keep our jobs in America. We want to keep middle class. And right now, they're trying to destroy it all.
We've worked through COVID-19. Day in, day out, 16 hours a day. We hung in there.
I worked every day during the pandemic.
They made the most money they've ever made last year during the pandemic, but yet they don't want to give us what we're asking for.
$29 billion in profits, and you shut two plants. They're wondering who's next.
We lost cheese nips last year. It's different products that we've had here, and we're losing it, and they're going to Mexico.
You can't even talk about Mexico. You know, what I'm hearing is they make something like 96 cents an hour or 97 cents an hour. So we it's hard for us to compete against them.
Company would rather have profit than to have quality product. And to send it to Mexico, they're getting the profit. That's it. It's money. Nothing else matters.
We can't even hardly find packages from our plant in the store.
We understand it's a business, but outside of the business, we are all people.
We're not even really asking for anything much. We just want a fair contract. Just don't take anything from us. They had record profits last year, like I said, and they've sustained sales this year, and they want to take more from us. They just closed two more U.S. bakeries in the last 2 months. We lost another 1,000 members. Those jobs that are lost, and the product is being made in Mexico. So they have two of the biggest state-of-the-art bakery plants
in
Salinas, Mexico, and Monterrey, Mexico. And that's where the product is coming from now. So we just had enough. We want to be treated with a little bit of respect and get a fair contract. That's all we want.
That was audio by A More Perfect Union and a collage of workers' voices.
2 years gone by, but still thy never, ever cross a picky line. With their wives and children they stand together, never cross a picky line. We must never cross a picky line. Look away, look away, look away up west to San Francisco. Look away, look away, look away down south to Sydney Harbour. With the talkers have organised world's longest picket line. Technically this is an illegal strike, never cross a picket line. But technically workers have no rights, never cross a picket line. You must never cross a picket line.
That was Never Cross a Picket Line by Billy Bragg. In San Francisco, students, UESF teachers, and SEIU staff are being told to go back to work without testing protocols, proper masks, or windows that work. We recorded voices at a rally last week on August 31st, where students and teachers were demanding COVID health and safety protocols to save lives.
My name is Charlotte, and I'm a teacher at Buena Vista Horace Mann, and I'm here because our students need to be able to learn in an environment that is safe, where they have air to breathe that is clean, and that's not currently possible in our building. Our building needs extensive renovation. It's extremely old, and it's starting to get to the point where it's impacting student safety, and we can't stand for that, and we need to take some kind of action to let it be known that our school and our community is not going to stand by and allow these conditions to continue. There wasn't a whole lot done to make the building the kind of facility that we really need. I mean, we've had multiple incidents where students are not safe. our quality of life is being impacted, and something needs to be done to make our building the kind of institution that our students deserve. There's a rodent infestation. The infrastructure is crumbling. The electric system is, a student received an electric shock. Like, it's an incredibly old building. We had a gas leak last week. Like, this, these are conditions that just cannot be allowed to continue. In the wealthiest city in the country, in the world, students are going to school in a rat-infested building that could kill them, that could give them an electric shock, or there could be a gas explosion. And it's unacceptable, and it would not be happening at a school with demographics that look different. Because we're at a primarily low socioeconomic status and primarily Latinx school, we're not given the kind of resources that we need to be given for it to be equitable.
Cassandra Curiel, president of UESF.
We know that students are getting COVID, and disproportionately, it only makes sense. The narrative that students don't get them in schools is a false narrative. It's not that they don't get them in schools, it's that school districts have systematic levels of discipline, which is just behavior. We know we can help hundreds and hundreds of students in our building behave consistently. We know that. But we also know that COVID is running rampant, surging in communities, and we know that the most vulnerable people are unvaccinated, and we're in person, so who are the most vulnerable people? Our youngest students, and we don't want anything bad to happen to them. Therefore, these measures that we are demanding are both proactive and immediately needed. You know, there's been a lot of folks who have been operating in schools across different places, across the state and the globe, where with all of the mitigation strategies in place, it is totally possible and safe to do so. We love teaching in person. Educators love teaching in person. We want the children to be safe while they're learning. And we know that they can't do that if we don't have safe school sites to do that. Our working conditions are student learning conditions, which is why educators always fight for communities and schools. San Francisco Department of Public Health doesn't require the testing of anyone. You can check. They have more specifics on their website. They're very clear with their COVID. They have created the floor of standards, not the ceiling. That the school district cannot do this alone. We know that the school district can do everything they can and more when they're working with the other municipal powers that be, right? We need them to be working with DPH. We need them to be working with the city, not just the supervisors, but also the mayor, to implement a widespread strategy of the best quality of education in person. And the way to do that during COVID and during air quality crisis is to have universal testing for everyone. We need to have high quality masks available for everyone. And we need every school space to have air purifiers for when we do have to realistically close the window. We don't want to close schools. We want to stay open safely. That's what needs to happen. So the only thing that was required was DPH clearance. And DPH, according to the school district, cleared every single school site before it opened. We're talking about systemically underfunding school sites for years. We're talking about Prop 13 from the 1970s that continues in place. We put forward and helped support to get Prop 15 on the ballot years ago, 2 years ago, to try and get a refresh just on commercial property alone. The Disneyland and Chevron, for example, and Shell, some of the largest landholders in California, would pay property taxes at 2021 rates instead of paying the 1970 rates that they currently pay. That money for property taxes that is currently being held as wealth in this systemic situation is what contributes to the chronic underfunding of the infrastructure of these students that could have been dealt with had there been an ongoing influx for capital improvements.
Was Jive Soweto by Sifo Hot Sticks Mabuse. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The rise of fascism around the world is a serious danger to working people, according to Vermont AFL-CIO President David Van Dusen. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to him about what labor needs to do to fight it.
The issue of rise of fascism, the fascists aren't going away. They are organized. And as you said, their right-wingers want to disenfranchise Black, brown people, Native American people from voting. And the Congress, even though it's controlled by the Democrats, is not moving to eliminate the filibuster, which means that the PRO Act, all this legislation, can be basically stopped unless there's an end to the filibuster. How do you see that in relationship to labor's, the national AFL-CIO's plan to get any kind of reform through legislation and emails and trying to lobby the congresspeople? It seems that's their major organizing effort around changing the situation.
Well, let me be clear. The Vermont AFL-CIO fully supports the PRO Act, fully supports the Voting Rights Act, fully supports the human infrastructure effort in the budget and the infrastructure bill. But we see those as very, very modest, small first steps in what we really need to see as a much larger, much far-reaching Green New Deal, union-led Green New Deal. But are you not surprised that things like the PRO Act haven't passed and the filibuster is still there? I mean, the Democratic Party has not been a reliable ally of labor since FDR and the Great Depression. That was quite a long time ago, by my count. So if you think that us electing majority of the Democratic Party into Congress and taking the White House is going to fundamentally change anything, I would say you're insane. I mean, we did that under Obama. We've done that time and again, done that under Jimmy Carter. You know, we've done it over and over and over again. And yet our rights as working people seem to go backwards, not forwards. The Democratic Party is not a friend of organized labor as a party. There are individuals who are, but not as a party. And the national AFL-CIO would be wise to step away from the Democratic Party, take the tens of millions of dollars we fruitlessly sink into elections and put them into organizing. Put a staff of real organizers in every single state in the country to help our state federations and our affiliates organize new workers and to organize internally towards social and political ends. This is what the national AFL-CIO needs to do. But I don't presently see signs of that happening. This is why we need to change the culture from within of the AFL-CIO. Federations like ours, more left-leaning or more radical locals or progressive locals around the country need to step up. They need to pressure their internationals. They need to pressure the national leadership, the AFL-CIO, to make these kind of changes and these strategic shifts that have been demanded by facts on the ground for decades and generations, but where folks have not had the vision or the courage to take that leap. So that's what we need to do.
And there's been a rise of incidents, racist incidents, not just in the community, but on the job, hanging nooses. There doesn't seem to be any national campaign by labor against these racist attacks in an organized way. What can change that? Because these large number of workers are being terrorized, not just in the community, by the police, but by incidents on the job, and these continue.
Well, we have to be more proactive in addressing community concerns, for sure. Like if you look at a number of our unions, like AFSCME, like the UAW, we have a huge amount of folks from the BIPOC communities who are members, right? So they share our concerns too about the safety in their communities. But we need to think about labor not just as something that deals with contracts, that deals with narrow self-interest in the factory. We have to think about labor as a social and political force that reaches down in the communities and not as only is willing to picket or strike to win a raise, which they shouldn't, but also willing to step up and take direct action to defend working class communities, the same communities that they live in. On September 18th and 19th, we're slated to have our Vermont AFL-CIO convention. It's an election year, by the way, and our United slate is running a full slate for office once again. But we're also going to be considering a resolution that would put the Vermont AFL-CIO on record as militantly anti-fascist, willing to defend our communities, and also in opposition to gun control. And that might be surprising to some of your listeners, But part of our thinking here is we need the right wing, the far right, is armed. They're armed to the teeth. There's not a law that you could pass in the world that would take those guns away from them. They represent an imminent and dangerous threat to BIPOC communities, to working class communities, to low income communities, and to democracy herself. So what we are going to do is we're going to take a strong stance. We're going to have our members decide if we take a strong stance against gun control in order to allow us, continue to allow us the means to defend our communities if violent insurrections or lone wolf extremist attacks were to occur, be it in the workplaces or in our communities.
That was Pacifica's Steve Seltzer talking to Vermont AFL-CIO President David Van Dusen. U.S. trade unionists are fighting to defend Palestinian workers and their families who are under attack. Resolutions have been passed throughout the country by many union locals, including the American Federation of Teachers, City University of New York Professional Staff Congress, and Communication Workers of America, United Professional and Technical Employees. Thomas O'Rourke of WPFW interviewed CUNY professor Carol Lang about their struggles for the rights of Palestinian workers.
But my name is Carol Lang. I'm an adjunct professor at Bronx Community College, which is part of the City University of New York. And I'm in the PFC, which is a local in the AFT. And the way I got involved in this was, I mean, I've always been involved, but during the day of the last bombing or the major bombing in Gaza, a number of us in the PFC, we have three different committees. One of them is the international, one is in the academic, and the other one is the anti-racism committee, decided to draw up a resolution saying how horrified we were at what the events were. And we were forced to present it, or we presented it to the executive committee, which completely nixed it and rewrote their own, which had no substance or teeth or anything. And then after that, when we got it back, we refused to negotiate it with the EC. And what we did was we took their substitute resolution and put in amendments that would make it stronger. One that, you know, ended a call for the ending of military support to Israel, for the discussion of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And we took that to the Delegate Assembly, which passed.
Ms. Lang, why and how do you believe passing this resolution will help your union have an impact on the defense of struggle for Palestinian rights?
Well, I first of all, unfortunately, this resolution is not going to go anywhere. We were hoping to build something within the AFT in order to push the leadership to, you know, at the very least put the demands on government to stop funding these attacks by Israel on the Palestinians. But, you know, secondarily, what we're hoping to do, we're organizing, you know, teach-ins and panels, which are going to start tonight, on the history of, you know, the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, but about colonial settler states in general, and, you know, and how, yeah, you know, that encourages racism. But I just want to say that it's only going to be with the working class saying no. And, you know, and that's going to stop any of these attacks on the Palestinians. I believe that the working class really has to organize strikes against the, you know, the policies of both the AFL and the American government, which supports Israel.
Thank you, Carol. This is Thomas O'Rourke with COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Si no creyera en la locura de la garganta del sinsonte, si no creyera que en el monte se esconde el trino y la pavura, si no creyera en la balanza, en la razón del equilibrio, si no creyera en el delirio, si no creyera en la esperanza, si no creyera en lo que agencio, si no creyera en mi camino, si no creyera en mi sonido, si no creyera en mi silencio, ¡ay, qué cosa fuera! ¡Qué cosa fuera! La masa sin cantera, una masa y cuecha de cuerdas y tendones, un revoltijo de carnes con madera, un instrumento sin mejores pretensiones, que lucecitas montadas para escena. ¡Qué cosa fuera, corazón! ¡Qué cosa fuera! ¡Qué cosa fuera! La masa sin cantera, un testaferro del traidor de los aplausos, un servidor de pasado en copa nueva, un eternizador de dioses del ocaso, júbilo hervido con trapo y lentejuela. ¡Qué cosa fuera, corazón! ¡Qué cosa fuera! ¡Qué cosa fuera!
That was La Masa by Mercedes Sosa. The deaths of New York public transit workers from COVID was catastrophic. Now, this past week, these same public transit workers are fighting a massive flood caused by global warming. Pacifica heard from TWU Local 100 train operators Anthony Steiniger and Tom Greatmeyer.
Hi, my name is Anthony Steiniger. I'm also a train operator with New York City Transit. I'm a member of the union. I'm also a member of a coalition within the union, Local 100 Fight Back, where we advocate for workers. From what I know, obviously the system was shut down for a little more than a day because of flooding. And because it was shut down, that shows that MTA wasn't prepared for the flooding. And I really don't know what their plans are to get prepared. I mean, a few years back when there was extensive flooding, they did some things. They raised some of the grates. They renovated some of the drains. You know, that was highly publicized, the things that they did. But obviously, it wasn't enough. And thank God, you know, to my knowledge, there weren't any deaths in the system or any serious injuries.
My name is Tom Grudemeyer. I'm a train operator with New York City Transit, a member of the Transit Workers Union, Local 100. My memory of Hurricane Sandy was that there was advanced notice that it was on its way to New York and lots of speculation about what was going to be the extent of the damage. And I remember the transit was talking about it, but that's about as far as it went. Obviously, there was no real preparation or investment in anything that might have prevented a lot of the under-river tunnels flooding and being essentially destroyed. The Montague Tube that connects Brooklyn to Lower Manhattan was completely ruined and had to be shut down for 14 months. And everything, the concrete was jackhammered out, entirely new rails and all new signals were installed in that. The tunnel for the L line was also heavily damaged and had to undergo a lengthy rehabilitation process. But this time we were completely caught off guard. I didn't hear, there was not a single announcement from the MTA officials. There was no superintendent that came down and said, listen, the storm's really picking up. Looks like it could be bad. We need to be ready for this. Just remember, don't enter any flooded, nothing. There was nothing. And the rain had started just, I don't know, maybe an hour, 2 hours before I finished work. And I was on my way home. And my first note was that walking from the station to my apartment, I got completely, entirely drenched, soaked. And then about that, while I was walking, I actually got an alert on my smartphone from the weather thing saying that there was flash flood warnings and that traveling was advised to not travel unless it was absolutely necessary. And it wasn't until the next morning when I actually got up and it was beautiful outside and I was on my way to work and nothing was running. There was no service in the Queens corridor where I live.
You know, you manage as best you can with something like that. I mean,
There was widespread flooding, but some lines were more affected than others. And, you know, this has happened before I've been here with snowstorms, with Hurricane Sandy. It's just, you know, you manage as best you can. But it's not just this one instance with the flood. It's overall a decaying system. It's a system that's 100 years old, that is in desperate need of modernization, and taxing the wealthy in order to pay for it would be a start in getting this vital system to where it needs to be. The flood, you know, it was horrible for some of my coworkers who were trapped on their trains, who couldn't get home after their shifts. Others who had to work, you know, 16 hours. I was fortunate. I got off work before the floods began. But a lot of my coworkers had to, you know, endure, you know, some over 16 hours on the train. You know, they're with customers, trying to help customers as best they could. But the system needs to be modernized. We need to prepare for these types of instances. The once in a 100-year storm is going to become, you know, frequent. It's going to become routine. It's going to be once every year. You know, for the past few years, we've been getting tropical storms here in New York every single year, some worse than others. It's something that didn't happen 20 years ago. But now for the past 5-6 years, it seems that we have a tropical storm every year. And the system, it's vital that the system is prepared for it. And it's a crisis now because they didn't prepare for it before when they knew it was coming. The workers are left out in the lurch. We're left out to fend for ourselves. I had COVID. I contracted it March 18th of last year, back in the beginning of this pandemic. And I'm almost 90% certain that I contracted COVID from the New York City transit system, from being a transit worker and being a train operator in an enclosed space with, you know, people who weren't masked at the time and poor ventilation. You know, a passenger may stay on the train for a limited amount of time. They're going from one destination to the other. They may be there for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever. We're there from end to end, whether it's the shorter runs of about 50 minutes to the longer runs that are almost 2 hours at some times, hour and 45 minutes. And we're there for several trips. So we're there being exposed constantly if anybody's there who has COVID. There has been no effort here almost 2 years now, 18 months or more after the beginning of the pandemic. There has been no effort to improve ventilation on the train. There has been no effort to isolate our cars or give us some distance, social distance, from the passengers. A passenger can walk right up to my door and lean against my door and just stay there for the entire ride without a mask. And there's no real effort or no real means other than me asking them to move or stand away. There's no formal means, nothing put in place by the MTA to keep those passengers at least 6 feet away from us. So you couple that with still no real filtration system in the trains and poor ventilation, and we're still being exposed. You can look in the news and you see the reports of school systems in some of these places where, you know, they're having to fight to just have something like masks on the students and the faculty. It's insanity. It's you know, it's like there's no regard for workers' lives. It's we're essential, but we're expendable.
That was a report on workers facing both COVID and the flood in the New York City transit system.
In our union, we've adopted a slogan almost 30 years ago. And when we're in a battle, what we say is defeat is not an option. It doesn't matter where you're from. I can feel the arc of fairness and the arc of justice being bent our way now.
Let us never forget
What we fought for 100 years, with blood, sweat, broken bones, death and tears. They call us radicals and thugs, but we're just misunderstood, standing in the same place that my father and my grandfather stood. Respect and honesty, pensions, benefits and salary, support my family, defending human rights instead of minimum wage. The punch clock, slave trade, get engaged, operate, fight the corporation every day. There's no justice for the working man, and nothing comes for free to us working men. So much corruption from the waking man, 'cause there's no jobs out there for us working men. I bet they never worked a day at all. I bet they never worked a day at all.
That was No Justice for Working Men by Mickey O'Brien. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. 700 longshore workers from Los Angeles International Longshore Workers Union Local 13 have been infected with COVID, and 13 have died, slowing work on the docks. KPFK's Margaret Prescott of Sojourner Truth interviewed ILWU Local 13 President Ramon Ponce de Leon about the failure to protect workers from COVID and the chaos in our transportation system.
They come out with a flimsy excuse by saying it's the fabric of the union, the law. We know. We've been outside the law for 12 months. The law says we must cross the picket line. We didn't cross the picket line.
I'd also like to welcome Ramon Ponce de Leon, president of ILWU Local 13. He is a third generation longshoreman and has been in the industry for nearly four decades. He has been dealing with the COVID pandemic amongst his members, who are very important essential workers that operate the Los Angeles Long Beach ports. These are the union's largest ports that supply food and goods for the United States and the world. Ramon Ponce de Leon, welcome.
Good morning, Margaret.
And perhaps, Ramon, starting with you, because the COVID-19 pandemic devastating in so many ways. And we also note, by the way, that nationally, labor union membership are kind of split on the COVID, you know, whether to wear a mask, whether to get vaccinated, etc. But I'd like you to talk a little bit as on this, our Labor Day special, of the challenges that workers, the longshoremen, are facing. Because a lot of people are, you know, very unaware of the essential work done by longshoremen.
Kind of hard. I've been going through this for the past year and a half, I'm going to have to regress in the memory banks here, because we've also incurred the congestion situation. So that's been the hot topic. Going back to the beginning, March, sometime late March, the COVID hit the U.S. and us in Southern California, particularly where individuals were required to wear a mask and the protocols were being initiated. There was no blueprint on how to handle a pandemic, so everything was ad lib. Everybody was just doing whatever guidelines or agencies were sending down to us. There was a lot of chaos of who has the jurisdiction on what the protocols would be. So our Coast Labor Relations Committee, along with the PMA, designated the protocols to follow the CDC guidelines. And because, you know, we have OSHA, you have the health department, you have various agencies in the state, everybody telling us how to work safe. Anyway, the mask issue was very relatively not as big as we thought it would be. For the most part, the members of the ILWU, Class A, Class B, and the casuals all understood that the cargo needed to be we needed to continue working and supplying the cargo, because we are a vital component to this nation's goods supply from the ocean carrying cargo. So they understood that, and for the most part, everybody wore a mask. There were some hiccups, the shield issue, and a few minor things, but for the most part, the mask issue on the protocol initially there was a lot of cooperation. Although we couldn't get N95, we couldn't get the proper PPE because it was going to the first responders. Most of our people were wearing cloth masks, which people do today. And you know, the CDC at that time, and it still says that the virus is only stopped with a proper PPE, which would be an N95, and now we have this K95. But our workers, that was some of the crossfire. But we told them, in any case, you're going to help each other, you're going to wear the mask, and you're going to go to work. So we all did.
Ramon Ponce de Leon, president of ILWU Local 13.
The future is still uncertain with the need. The e-commerce has hit. People have went to buying online rather than going to stores. And because of the pandemic, they aren't taking as many vacations or going out to visit restaurants and so and that. What so the challenge has been people have doubled their buying power by the e-commerce. And there is no equipment available. It's all stuck somewhere. Chicago was shut down for 7 days. That's the rail hub, which is one of the hubs we feed through Southern California by rail. Trucking has taken. If you go on the roads today, it's so crowded, and the congestion is everywhere, all over the world. So the congestion, as a result of the pandemic and the exposure of the e-commerce that nobody was ready for. Not anybody in the world was ready for the e-commerce. So the congestion, along with trying to stay healthy and trying to get people back to work during COVID, these are challenges not just with us, but that's for everybody around the world. One of the challenges is trying to get together with everybody. As a common goal to get answers and solutions to get the economy back on a stable and consistent flow.
That was International Longshore Workers Union Local 13, President Ramon Ponce de Leon, speaking with the host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. The defeat of the United States in Afghanistan after a 21-year war raises the question of what role labor should and is playing internationally. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed Professor Kim Sipes about the role of the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center, which receives more than $30 million a year from the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy. Sipes asks if this is what U.S. workers need or really even know about.
This is Steve Seltzer. The collapse of the United States-supported government and military in Afghanistan raises real questions about the future of the United States internationally. And one person that has raised the issue of what the labor is doing internationally is Kim Sipes. He's the author of the AFL-CIO's Secret War Against Developing Country Workers, Solidarity or Sabotage, and KMU, Building Genuine Trade Unionism in the Philippines, 1980 to 1994. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
So, Kim, you have spent a good part of your career as an academic, a professor, studying the role of U.S. unions internationally, and the United States right now is being defeated or has been defeated in Afghanistan militarily, yet the United States has over 800 bases all over the world. It spends $750 billion a year on the military. And what is the relationship of the U.S. unions to the U.S. military and U.S. interventions around the world?
One of the things that I did in my book that you mentioned, from which was published in 2010, was that I really tried to understand the AFL-CIO's foreign policy. Now, a lot of people don't think it has a foreign policy, but that's not true. They have had it. It was started in the late 1800s under Samuel Gompers. It has developed over the years. It's something that's not talked about. It's not even acknowledged. members of the AFL-CIO unions generally do not know anything about it. So it's a subject, while near and dear to my heart, is largely unknown to a lot of people. And what I came to do in this book, and I've done in subsequent research, is I've tried to understand why. Because to me, you know, I would think, and this is the way I started out, was assuming that working people in the United States and their organizations, such as the AFL-CIO, would be out there working to help workers around the world improve their lives and try to make things better for them and their families and things such as this. Well, what I found out is the AFL-CIO, first initially under just the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, and then after the merger in 55, the AFL-CIO, has had its own foreign policy. And basically, that foreign policy is developed around the idea that the United States should run the world. Now, where they get this, I'm not certain. But this has been something that the AFL and then the AFL-CIO has been pushing, like I say, since the end of the 1800s. So what we have a history of is the AFL-CIO foreign apparatus. Now, keep in mind, it's separate from what's happening in the United States. Like I say, most unions don't even know this is out there. But they have been operating. They've been operating. Now, it's coming from within the union movement, but it means that they have worked with the CIA to help overthrow democratically elected governments, such as in Guatemala in 1954, in Brazil in 1964, and Chile in 1973. They also worked to help support the coup attempt in Venezuela in 2002. So we have this really weird phenomena. The American workers' labor organizations actually working against other workers in and across what we used to call the third world, the countries of Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. Now, and like I say, this is all being done behind the backs, but in the name of American workers. And I've been fighting, as you pointed out, for basically for over 40 years, along with people like the late Fred Hirsch, who was somebody I have a lot of respect for and work closely with, as well as others, to try to get American workers to start paying attention to this. In other words, to take their focus larger than just trade union concerns here in the United States, because this is happening around the world, like I say, behind our backs, with no knowledge of workers. So the AFL leaders have never given an honest report about what they're doing, where they're doing it, why they're doing it, why those countries, things like this. So, for example, today, the Solidarity Center, which is the international wing of the AFL-CIO, is operating in something like 60 countries. Why? What are they doing? Now, they're not as bad as it used to be. I'll admit that. Thank goodness. What they did in the past was absolutely atrocious. Today, now and then, they do a few good things, but we don't know what they're doing. And they have never, like I say, they have never given an honest report. They've never told us why they're in those countries. They've never told us what they're doing in those countries or anything such as this.
You have been trying to get information about the role of the AFL-CIO International. What are your efforts have been, and how have you been prevented from getting the information?
See, the main operation, the main program they're working through is an atrocious thing called the National Endowment for Democracy. Now, that sounds wonderful. National Endowment for Democracy. Who could be against democracy? Well, this was set up by that real Democrat-loving guy, Ronald Reagan, in 1983. And it was created through the U.S. Congress. It's funded by the U.S. Congress, and it's an operation that is designed to support the U.S. empire around the world. Now, I've got to stop for a minute here and explain what I mean there. In other words, I'm arguing that since at least 1945, and we could go earlier, but we'll stop at 45, that the entire United States foreign policy has been designed to advance the interests of the United States against every other country in the world. Now, while the Soviet Union was existing, so up till 1991, it couldn't get its way in those countries. But other than that, and since that, the U.S. has tried to run the world according to their issues and regardless of the impact on anybody in any other country. Now, we've been taught, we in the United States have been taught that the United States is this wonderful country, we do wonderful things around the world, and that our military is here to defend us. And I don't think that allows us to understand what's going on. What is going on is the elites in this country, including political and economic elites, and I'm including political leadership of both the Democrats and the Republicans, have been operating around the world trying to dominate other countries. It's not to defend the United States. It's to allow areas that they want to go into for geostrategic reasons or for minerals and raw materials, things like that. They want to be able to control the world any way they can. And the labor movement has worked with them. So we have the labor movement supposedly representing the interests of U.S. workers, not doing that, but representing and trying to advance the interests of the political and economic elites in this country. So, for example, they spend this year, they're going to spend $750 billion on the military alone. Now, that's under Joe Biden. It's even more than Donald Trump was spending. So it's not just a Democrat or a Republican thing. Both are involved. But anyway, that's $750 billion. It's basically going to the arms contractors. It's not to the vets. It's going to the arms contractors. And they're using it to advance their interests, to advance their profits. There was a meme going around the other day showing their profits. Some of them were up like 1,000% during the last 20 years when we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the idea that we're taking that $750 million, and this comes from the American people through our taxes, but the money going to the military cannot be spent for education, for healthcare, for infrastructure, for climate change, for any of these things that most of us think American workers should need, that they need and should have, I should say. It's being pushed away. It's encouraging the country to go into other countries to fight wars. I mean, the U.S. has fought almost continual wars ever since World War II, some acknowledged, some not, some with the CIA and supposedly secret. We know some of these things. There's still a lot of stuff that we don't know. But it's being done. They're stealing the money from working people in the United States and stealing that money and using it to give it to the arms producers and invading countries, killing women and children around the world, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's what the American labor movement should be doing.
That was Professor Kim Sipes in conversation with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people, men cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
That was Bomb the World by Michael Franti. That concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Seltzer with help from me and Garrison, and editing by Polina Vasilia. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.